Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. So today we're going to be talking about what I consider to be the best response physicalists have to the zombie argument, and why, like pretty much every zombie movie, they still get eaten at the end. So about 50 years ago, Saul Kripke and Hilary Putnam persuaded most analytic philosophers of the existence of what are called a posteriori necessities. And such truths are, as the name implies, not a priori. Despite not being knowable a priori, they are necessarily true. So why is this significant? Well, it can potentially rescue physicalism from Chalmers' horde of zombies. David Chalmers has an organization of different types of physicalism, and they don't all respond to an argument like the zombie argument in the same way. So type A physicalists think that there is an a priori conceptual entailment from the physical to the phenomenal, and this would imply that zombies are not ideally conceivable. And as we covered in the last episode, one of my arguments against this view was from the existence of the problem of other minds. If you think zombies are somehow conceptually confused and can be ruled out a priori, then you have accidentally dissolved the problem of other minds without remainder. This is a liability, since there clearly is a problem of other minds. And once physicalists realized they didn't have to defend this radical form of physicalism, the majority of them stopped defending it. They flocked to a posteriori physicalism, what would be classified as type B physicalism by Chalmers. So on type B physicalism, there is no a priori conceptual entailment from the physical to the phenomenal, which means it can be granted that zombies are at least conceivable. This is a huge advantage to this kind of physicalism, and it's held by the majority of contemporary physicalists, and may be best expressed by David Papineau, Brian Lohr, and formerly Michael Tye, who's since become a panpsychist. So basically, the type A physicalist is not even going to grant that there's an epistemic gap between the physical and the phenomenal, whereas the type B physicalist is perfectly comfortable with an epistemic gap. And of course, they're both still physicalists. They're both committed to the metaphysical impossibility of zombies. But type Bs are going to take advantage of this concept of an a posteriori necessity to defend their view. Okay, so what's an example of an a posteriori necessity in nature? Well, consider water and H2O. And by the way, physicalism, as far as I can tell, is basically the view that the mysteries of consciousness will be revealed through extensive contemplation of water and H2O. So you should probably get used to that. We can't discover through a priori armchair reflection that water is H2O. We have to go out in the world and make observations. According to Kripke and Putnam, it's a necessary truth that water is H2O, but it's one that we discovered empirically. We had to defer to empirical reality to figure that one out. If we imagine a twin Earth where the watery substance in the oceans and rivers is not H2O but XYZ, if it has some other chemical structure, despite sharing its macroscopic properties, then it would not really be water, the thinking goes. The external world plays a role in determining the meaning of our words. By water, I mean that stuff, all that watery stuff that's embedded in my world that falls from the sky and comes out my faucet. If I asked for a glass of water and Twin Putnam somehow teleported over from Twin Earth and, unbeknownst to me, handed over a glass of XYZ, he would be tricking me. That's not water. And honestly, he looks like the type to try to trick me somehow. So after Kripke and Putnam, most philosophers were convinced of the reality of a posteriori necessities. There can be necessary truths, they couldn't be otherwise, but they're not knowable a priori. And of course, we're just papering over a mountain of information. We're not going into any detail into Putnam's arguments or Kripke's arguments, because for our purposes, all you need to know is that this really comes in handy if you're trying to defend physicalism. You can grant the ideal conceivability of zombies. You can grant that there's an epistemic gap. So even though it's negatively ideally conceivable that water is not H2O, the sentence, water is not H2O, is necessarily false. There's an example of a necessary truth that is nonetheless conceivably false. So you can kind of see why physicalists latch onto this. If you're a physicalist and you're trying to defend the idea that necessarily there will be consciousness that comes along with any physical brain and body like ours, you can invoke the idea of an a posteriori necessity. That leaves room for the ideal conceivability of zombies, since it leaves room for the epistemic gap. So if you're a physicalist, the reality of a posteriori necessities is kind of a big deal for you. It's hard to overstate how much of a burden has been lifted off the Type B physicalist, as contrasted with the cluster of Type A views. Non-physicalists burn up a lot of energy trying to establish that there is an epistemic gap in the first place. It's a crucial part of the arguments against physicalism. If a posteriori physicalists can grant an epistemic gap while retaining a physicalist ontology, that puts them in a pretty nice position. It allows them to agree at least part of the way with non-physicalists. That's very good, because we're obviously right about some of this stuff. That's the great promise of a posteriori physicalism. It's the best of both worlds. As Philip Goff explains the Type B view, quote, post the Kripke-Putnam revolution, physicalists slowly started to realize that they had another option. Instead of denying the existence of phenomenal concepts, the physicalist might instead hold that they feature in a posteriori identities with physical or functional concepts. Just as water is a posteriori identical with H2O, so anxiety is a posteriori identical with brain state X. Just as it is conceivable but not possible that the glass in front of me contains water, while at the same time lacking H2O, so it is conceivable but not possible that the creature in front of me instantiates brain state X without experiencing anxiety. Even if we cannot, through armchair reasoning, give a priori analyses of facts about consciousness in terms of facts about causal structure, it may nonetheless be possible to empirically identify facts about consciousness with those facts about causal structure. For the Type A physicalist, zombies are inconceivable. Type B physicalists, in contrast, deny that the phenomenal truths can be deduced from complete knowledge of the physical truths. Despite this epistemological disagreement between Type A and Type B physicalists, as physicalists, both are united in holding that the fact that I'm anxious, and any other phenomenal fact, is constitutively grounded in the physical facts. And if the phenomenal facts are constitutively grounded in the physical facts, then zombies, whether or not they're conceivable, are impossible. Since philosophers realized that Type B physicalism was an option, Type A physicalism has not been so popular. Whether or not there's a metaphysical gap between the pure physical facts and the facts about consciousness, it's extremely plausible that there's an epistemic gap. End quote. It's physicalism that allows there to be an epistemic gap, that denies an a priori conceptual entailment from the physical to the phenomenal. It's physicalism without all the annoying side effects.
Or is it?
As Goff goes on to explain, there is an unwelcome consequence for the Type B view. It doesn't quite deliver on its best of both worlds promise. So the non-physicalist, if they want to defend the zombie argument, needs to reestablish the connection between conceivability and possibility despite the existence of a posteriori necessities. So I'll talk about David Chalmers' attempt to do this, which relies on what's called two-dimensional semantics, and Philip Goff's attempt to do this, which works regardless of whether we accept or reject two-dimensional semantics. According to Chalmers, there are two layers of meaning, as it were, to many of our sentences. We can divide things between the primary intention and the secondary intention, which roughly correspond to appearance and essence. Following Kripke, Chalmers thinks the essence of water is H2O, and that this picks out water across all possible worlds. But then there's the appearance of water, that wet, colorless, odorless stuff that falls from the sky and fills the oceans. For Chalmers, there are two aspects of meaning. The primary intention corresponds to appearance, and the secondary intention corresponds to essence. So in the case of water, the primary intention is basically your experience of water, you know, the appearance of that watery stuff, which would be the same whether you're on Earth or twin Earth. But the essence of water, the secondary intention, is H2O. That's what it really is. That's its essential nature. Within this framework of two-dimensional semantics, wherever the primary and secondary intentions differ, there will be a corresponding epistemic gap between conceivability and possibility. So Chalmers' semantic framework can sustain Kripkean a posteriori necessities, and it can also explain why conceivability would entail possibility in cases where the distinction between primary and secondary intentions collapse. What saves the zombie argument is that the appearance-essence distinction collapses when it comes to experience. When it comes to phenomenal consciousness, there aren't distinct primary and secondary intentions. If you know what pain feels like, then you know what pain is. The feeling is the essence of the experience. There's no way to pry open a gap between how it appears and what it is when it comes to experience. I like how Galen Strawson put it, quote, "When it comes to conscious experience, there's a rock-bottom sense in which we're fully acquainted with it just in having it. The having is the knowing." Philip Goff unpacks it a bit further, quote, "Water is essentially H2O, but we think about it in terms of one of its non-essential properties, being the watery stuff. In this sense, our thought about water is indirect. However, Kripke goes on to deny that this is the case when it comes to consciousness. We think about a pain in terms of how it feels, but how pain feels is not a non-essential way pain happens to appear to us. Pain just is a feeling. In contrast to thought about water, thought about pain is direct. In general, we think about a conscious state in terms of what it's like to be in it. In each case, there's no appearance property to be distinguished from the essence of the conscious state." And he calls this the direct reference thesis. So with all that in mind, we can offer an updated version of the conceivability argument based on two-dimensional semantics. One, P and nothing has Q is conceivably true. That's basically just the zombie world. Two, if a sentence is conceivably true, then its primary intention is true in some possible world. Conclusion one, the primary intention of P and nothing has Q is true in some possible world. Three, it is not the case that P and nothing has Q has a primary intention that differs from its secondary intention. Conclusion, the secondary intention of P and nothing has Q is true in some possible world, and hence physicalism is false. So the main problem for this argument is its underlying two-dimensional semantic framework. I've heard it criticized in fairly harsh terms before, but fortunately, we don't really need two-dimensional semantics to make the argument work. And this is why I've been relying so heavily thus far on Philip Goff's Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. Goff rejects the two-dimensional semantic framework. He thinks the argument goes through as long as we can defend phenomenal transparency. Well, actually, once we defend phenomenal transparency, there's sort of a more straightforward argument that presents itself. Quote, "My worry with Chalmers' conceivability argument is that it rests on highly contentious semantic assumptions, those assumed by the two-dimensional semantic framework in terms of which the argument is posed, which, in my view, Chalmers has never adequately justified. I try to show that what's really needed to make these kinds of arguments work is a commitment to phenomenal transparency. A concept is transparent just in case it reveals the nature of the entity it refers to in the sense that it is a priori for someone possessing the concept and in virtue of possessing the concept, what it is for that entity to be a part of reality. A plausible example is the concept of sphericity. For the property of sphericity to be instantiated is for there to be something with all points on its surface equidistant from its center. If you possess the concept of sphericity and you're clever enough, you can work that out from the armchair. A concept is opaque just in case it reveals little or nothing of the nature of the entity it refers to, that is, very little of what it is for that entity to be a part of reality is a priori accessible. The concept water is a plausible example of an opaque concept. For there to be water is for there to be stuff composed of H2O molecules, but this cannot be found out from the armchair. In contrast to sphericity, you have to actually do some science to find out the essential nature of water. Phenomenal transparency is the thesis that phenomenal concepts reveal the nature of the conscious states they refer to. By thinking about a particular pain in terms of what it's like, you can thereby come to know what it is for that pain to be instantiated, and in this respect, the concept of pain is more like the concept of sphericity than it is like the concept of water. So, if phenomenal transparency is true, then our phenomenal concepts give us an understanding of what conscious states are. But if we reject phenomenal transparency and instead hold that phenomenal concepts are opaque, kind of like water, then there's no way we could rule out from the armchair, making an argument like the zombie argument, that they are brain states. For all we know, they could be brain states. I mean, they're opaque concepts, or at least not transparent. So, without phenomenal transparency, there could still be an epistemic gap, as the type B physicalist maintains. But that epistemic gap would really have no metaphysical significance. It all hangs on whether our phenomenal concepts are transparent or not. So if Goff is right that our phenomenal concepts are transparent and we kind of know what they are in virtue of having them, we can't say, oh, you don't know the nature of pain. You've only had the feeling of pain. Well, pain is that feeling. It's not like water, which turns out to be H2O, but there's still an epistemic gap for us. That's not so with conscious states like pain. You know what consciousness is by virtue of being conscious. The having is the knowing. In other words, once we possess the phenomenal concept, and in virtue of possessing that concept, it's revealed a priori what it is for that entity to be a part of reality. A transparent concept is a concept that reveals the essence of the entity it refers to a priori to the concept user. Okay, so that's a transparent concept. Opaque concepts, as Goff puts it, are kind of like blind pointers, because we're just blindly pointing at that thing, that entity I know not what. So again, the way that this works out best for the a posteriori or type B physicalist is if our phenomenal concepts are opaque, if they're blind pointers. If you want the analogy with water and H2O to really hold, phenomenal concepts can't be transparent. I mean, there wouldn't be an epistemic gap between water and H2O if water was a transparent concept. The case of water and H2O is relevantly different from certain mathematical concepts and, very plausibly, phenomenal concepts. So Goff's claim is that a posteriori physicalism doesn't quite deliver what it promised, physicalism without all the weird side effects. In order for it to really work, our phenomenal concepts can't be transparent. Now, there are degrees of transparency and opacity, but it would be best for type B physicalism if phenomenal concepts were opaque, and at the very least, they can't be transparent. The problem is that our phenomenal concepts are definitely not opaque. Now, a lot of physicalists accept phenomenal transparency. They just don't realize the implication. If the essential nature of a concept is revealed a priori to the concept user, and phenomenal concepts are transparent, then if you're a physicalist, neuroscience should be very easy. You should know about the physical basis of all these mental events, because you're a physicalist, so you think consciousness is physical, and you accept phenomenal transparency. You think phenomenal concepts reveal their essence, a priori, to the concept user. Like, just put those two ideas together, physicalism and phenomenal transparency. So the essential nature of a conscious state is revealed to a subject just in virtue of being conscious. Also, phenomenal state X is really just brain state X. That's its essential nature. Okay, well then, physicalism plus phenomenal transparency means neuroscience should be very easy. Now, obviously, neuroscience is not easy, which means we can't have type B physicalism and phenomenal transparency. One of those things has to go. That's why if you're a type B physicalist, you're forced away from the transparency thesis, ideally, into the position that phenomenal concepts are opaque. They're just blind pointers. When you have an experience, you're just kind of blindly pointing at something and you don't know its nature at all. Could turn out to be anything. I know this has been a very dense episode, but the idea that phenomenal concepts are opaque is incredibly counterintuitive. Arguably, you've just lost sight of the target phenomenon if you think experience is opaque. So it's not that the having is the knowing. It's not that you know what pain is by feeling pain. Even if you have the feeling of pain, you still don't know what it is. You've got no clue about the essential nature of pain, even as you're feeling it. Okay, well that seems wrong. I'm pretty sure the feeling of pain is part of the essential nature of pain. If you want to keep your physicalism on the one hand and your epistemic gap on the other, this is supposed to be what's attractive about type B physicalism, then you have to defend phenomenal opacity. That's how you get an epistemic gap on the type B view. Unfortunately, tragically even, for the a posteriori physicalist, phenomenal opacity is part of the type B package. And Goff puts it in pretty strong terms. Quote, phenomenal opacity is manifestly an implausible view about phenomenal concepts. Surely when I attend to my pain introspectively, when I think about it in terms of how it feels, I understand something about its nature. That's why I care when other people feel pain. judgments of the moral significance of pain are difficult to make sense of if pain is just that thing, I know not what. In knowing how pain feels, I know something of what pain is. And it's this understanding that grounds my awareness that pain is, all else being equal, a bad thing. Type B physicalists often boast that, in contrast to analytic functionalism, their view captures our intuitive view about phenomenal concepts. But the view that phenomenal concepts are blind pointers seems to me just as revisionary as the view that phenomenal concepts admit of a priori causal analysis. End quote. So, assuming the truth of phenomenal transparency, we can offer an updated version of the zombie argument, one that relies on a conceivability principle that takes the distinction between transparent and opaque concepts into account. So here's the transparency conceivability argument. 1. P and nothing has Q is conceivably true. 2. If a transparent sentence is conceivably true, then it's possibly true. 3. P and nothing has Q is transparent. Conclusion: P and nothing has Q is possibly true, and so pure physicalism is false. So there's more to the story than this. There's more to say in defense of phenomenal transparency, and about different degrees of transparency and opacity. There's also more to say about the zombie argument after we accept phenomenal transparency. According to Goff, a more straightforward argument emerges against physicalism once we accept phenomenal transparency. So I'm going to be interviewing Philip Goff about the zombie argument, phenomenal transparency, a posteriori physicalism, and the like. So if you've got questions, or need some clarification, or have a devastating objection, then we will answer it. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.